You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Light Course, given for the newly formed Waldorf School teachers. This is Lecture 8, given in Stuttgart on December 31st, 1919. Conventional descriptions of physics have described tone and sound in the current manner only since the 15th century, more or less. It's just such examples that corroborate what I've often expressed as an insight of spiritual science, that people's entire way of thinking and imagining was different before the turn of this age than it was after. Moreover, this way of speaking about sound phenomena only gradually took on the academic form in which we speak today. The first thing people became aware of was the speed with which sound is propagated. It is relatively easy to get an idea of the speed of sound propagation, at least with a certain approximation. If you shoot off a cannon at some distance, you see the flash of the light phenomenon far off, and afterward hear the bang, just as you hear thunder later than you see lightning. If you ignore the speed of light, the time that passes between the perception of the light impression and the perception of the sound can be regarded as the time it took the sound to travel the given distance. Then you can calculate how quickly sound travels in air, say in 1 second, and arrive at something like the speed of the propagation of sound. That was one of the first aspects people became aware of in this era, in this area. What we call resonance also drew their attention, especially that of Leonardo da Vinci. Today you know this as sympathetic vibrations. If a string is struck in a space where there is another string or another object with the same tuning, the other string or object will vibrate sympathetically. The Jesuits in particular studied such things. For example, in the 17th century, the Jesuit Mersenne accomplished a great deal for the theory of sound or tone in connection with studies on pitch. You can distinguish three elements of a sound. First, the sound has a certain loudness. Second, it has a certain pitch. And, in addition, it has a certain quality. Of the three, the most important, the most essential, is the pitch. Now, it's a matter of determining what the source of pitch is from the point of view that gradually developed, particularly in the study of sound. As I've already pointed out, when we perceive a sound, the cause, or let's say, the concurrent phenomenon, is something that is vibrating. It's very easy to establish the vibrating condition of the air or other bodies by the usual experiments. It's not necessary to discuss these experiments in detail. All you have to do is imagine yourself back in school. You strike something like a tuning fork, and then follow the line with a pencil attached to it. In the image it reproduces in soot, you will see that the tuning fork is moving regularly. It goes without saying that this regular motion is conducted to the air. Thus it can be said that whenever we hear a sounding body, the air between it and us is in motion. We put the air directly into motion, of course, in the devices that we call pipes. People gradually arrived at an understanding of what kind of motion is involved. We are dealing with so-called longitudinal vibrations. The fact that we are dealing with longitudinal vibrations can also be proven. You generate a tone in a metal pipe and connect the pipe with a tube filled with air, so that it conducts the motions of the metal pipe. If, to the air-filled tube, you add dust that is easily moved, you will be able to ascertain from the motion of the particles of dust that the sound continues as follows. First, there is compression of the air. This compression of the air is pushed back in turn when the body vibrates back, thereby producing an expansion of the air. At the moment when the metal moves forward, the original compression moves forward. Compression and expansion alternate in this fashion. Thus, it is experimentally possible to prove that compression and expansion are involved. It really isn't necessary for us to carry out such experiments, since these things are obvious, if I may say so. I don't want to present you with anything that can be gotten out of books. At the beginning of the modern era, the Jesuits, with the help of their social connections, accomplished an extraordinary amount, particularly for such branches of physics. However, they always endeavored not to penetrate natural processes spiritually in any way, or to observe the spiritual element in natural processes, but to reserve spirituality for religious life. The Jesuit side always regarded it as dangerous to apply to natural phenomena a spirit-suited method of looking at things, to use the expression we are accustomed to hearing from Goethe. The Jesuits wanted to look at nature purely materialistically, in no way approaching nature with the spirit. And in many respects, they were the first keepers of the materialistic views that are particularly dominant today. We don't think about the fact, although we know it historically, that the way of thinking employed in today's physics is basically a product of this Catholic tendency. Now, we are chiefly concerned with why we hear sounds with different pitches. In what ways do the differences in external vibration phenomena that appear in sound relate to the differences in pitches? We can show these things by experiments like the one that we are going to demonstrate. We will cause this disc with different rows of holes to move rapidly, and Mr. Stockmeyer will then be so kind as to direct a stream of air at this moving disc. In brackets, this is done. You can easily distinguish how the pitch differed. What caused this difference? It was caused by the fact that we have a smaller number of holes on the inner part of the disc, only 40 holes. When Mr. Stockmeyer directed the stream of air at the disc, the stream went through when it came to a hole, but wasn't able to go through between the holes, and so forth. Because of the movement of the disc, the next hole arrived in place of the previous one. And in this way, as many gusts of air were caused as holes arrived at the spot where the stream of air was passing. Because of this, we have 40 gusts of air on the inside here, and on the outside circle we have 80 gusts of air. The gusts of air cause waves, vibrations. Therefore, in the same time period, because these 80 holes complete a turn in the same amount of time as the 40 inner holes, we have 80 gusts of air one time, 80 vibrations of air, and 40 gusts of air, 40 vibrations of the air the other time. The sound that results when we have 80 vibrations is twice as high as the one that results when we have 40 vibrations. By these and similar experiments, we can prove that pitch correlates to the number of vibrations that take place in the medium in which the sound is propagated. If you take what a vibration consists of, in other words, one compression and one expansion, we can call that the wavelength. Now, if in 1 second n waves of the length L are generated, then the whole wave movement progresses at the rate of n times L. That is, the path that the whole wave movement travels in 1 second, I'll call it V, is n times L. Now, I'll ask you to remember what I referred to in my previous reflections. I told you that we have to carefully distinguish everything that is kinematic from those things that have not simply been invented by the inner life of the imagination, but are external realities. I also told you that external realities can never exist solely in terms of number, space, and movement. Speeds are always external realities. Naturally, it is no different when we speak of sound. Outward experience doesn't consist of either L or N, for L is merely spatial and N is merely a number. It is in speed that reality lies. And when I divide into two abstractions, the speed contained within the being that I call sound, then naturally I don't get any actual realities. Rather, I get what has been abstracted, separated, and compartmentalized. Wavelengths, spatial measurements, and the number n are all such compartmentalized abstractions. If I want to look at the reality of sound, at what is real externally, I have to look at the inner ability of sound to have speed. That is what leads to a qualitative examination of sound. While the view we are accustomed to in physics today is a quantitative examination of sound. It is particularly striking that in acoustics, what can be noted in terms of space, time, movement, and number is nearly always substituted for the qualitative, which expresses itself solely in terms of a certain capacity for speed. These days, we no longer notice at all how even in acoustics, we have basically wandered off into dangerous materialistic territory. We can say that it's so obvious that sound as such just doesn't exist outside of us. Outside of us, there are simply vibrations. How could anything be clearer than this? When a stream of air is produced, which creates compressions and expansions, and my ear hears them, then that unknown something within me, which physicists don't have to go into, of course, because that's not physics, converts the air vibrations into purely subjective experiences, converting the vibrations of bodies into the qualitative nature of sound. And you will find expressed in the most diverse ways the idea that outside of us vibrations exist, but that inside of us are the effects of these vibrations, which, however, are purely subjective. This idea has gradually become second nature to us, with results like those you can find cited from Robert Hemmerling's works in my title Riddles of Philosophy. Hemmerling, in Taking Up the Theories of Physics, says right from the outset that what we experience as an explosion is nothing but a disturbance of the air outside of us. And whoever can't believe that what we actually experience as a sensation is only within us, and that externally there is just vibrating air or vibrating ether, shouldn't read any further in a book such as those written by Robert Hemmerling. Hemmerling even states that someone who believes that a picture of a horse really corresponds to an outer reality doesn't understand anything and should shut his book. But, my dear friends, we have to follow such things to their logical conclusion. Imagine if I were to treat you, who are sitting here in accordance with this physical way of thinking, parenthesis, quote, way of thinking, close quote, I say not, in quotes, method, close parenthesis, that physicists are accustomed to applying to sound and light phenomena. Let me read that sentence again. Imagine if I were to treat you, who are sitting here, in accordance with this physical way of thinking, that physicists are accustomed to applying to sound and light phenomena. Then all of you sitting before me would, of course, be in front of me only by means of my impressions, which are completely subjective, like sensations of light and sound. Indeed, outside of me, none of you would exist as I see you. Instead, it would only be the vibrations of the air between you and me that lead me to the vibrations that in turn are in you. This actually would bring me to the point where your entire inner soul life, which of course, as far as you are concerned, is undeniably in you, wouldn't really exist. Instead, for me, the inner soul life of all of you who are sitting here would merely be the effect of my own psyche. Otherwise, there would merely be some heaps of vibrations sitting on the benches here. It's the same kind of thinking if you deny light and sound the inwardness that you apparently experience subjectively. It's exactly the same as when I have you here before me, and regard what I have in front of me only as something subjective inside of me, denying that you experience this same inwardness. What I am saying now is apparently so obvious and banal that physicists and physiologists naturally can't imagine committing such errors. But they do it anyway. This whole distinction between the subjective impression, what is supposedly subjective, and the objective process is nothing else. Naturally, they could go about things honestly and say, quote, as a physicist, I don't want to investigate sound at all. I don't want to go into the qualitative aspects. I want to leave that alone and investigate only the external spatial, let's not say objective processes, which nevertheless continue on into me. I want to separate them as abstractions from the totality, and I am not getting involved with the qualitative. Close quote. Then they would indeed be honest, but they shouldn't then assert that this is something objective and that is something subjective, or even that one is the effect of the other. For what you experience in your soul is not, if I share in the experience, the effect of your brain vibrations on me. To meet the demands of modern times and modern science, it is critical to understand these things. In other words, with such things, we can't avoid delving into deeper connections. We can easily say, for example, that the purely vibratory nature of sound follows from the fact that if I pluck a string, another string in the same space and tuned to the same pitch will vibrate sympathetically. That is simply based on the fact that the intervening medium propagates the accompanying vibrations. However, we can understand what we observe here if we don't grasp it as part of a much more general phenomenon. The following is the more general phenomenon, which indeed has also been observed. Let's assume you have a pendulum clock that you have gotten going, and in the same room there is another pendulum clock. It has to be constructed, mind you, in a certain fashion, which you don't start going. You will discover that occasionally, when the conditions are favorable, the second pendulum clock will start running by itself. This is something we call the sympathy of phenomena, and it can be investigated in broad areas. The last of this type of phenomena that still has something to do with the outer world is one that could be investigated much more than it usually is, because it actually occurs often. You can experience it countless times. You are sitting at a table with a person who says something you have just thought. You thought it, but you haven't said it. And the other person expresses it. This is the sympathetic coincidence of events, of connected events that are somehow attuned to each other, which in this case manifests itself in a highly spiritual area. And we will have to discern a continuous series of facts between the simple, sympathetic vibration of a string, which, in accordance with unsophisticated notions, we regard materialistically, as merely another occurrence fitting into external material events, and those parallel phenomena that manifest themselves more spiritually, such as the co-experience of thoughts. But we won't be able to get clear insights into these things unless we are willing to deal with how the human being also fits into what we call physical nature. You'll remember that we showed the human eye a few days ago and analyzed it a bit. Today we will show the human ear. As you know, of course, in the back of the human eye is the vitreous body, which we can say still has vitality. And then there is the fluid between the lens and the cornea. As you go from the outside to the inside, the eye becomes more and more alive. Outside is more of a physical nature. We can also describe the ear in the same way that we can describe the eye, saying in a superficial way that just as light makes an impression on the eye by affecting the eye, or however you want to say it, so that the nerve receives the stimulus, the sound vibrations act upon the ear, enter the auditory canal, and beat on the eardrum, which closes off the auditory canal. Placed on the back of the eardrum are the ossicles, the hammer, anvil, and stirrup, named after their shapes. Thus, in physical terms, what originates and expresses itself externally in the air, in the form of compression and expansion waves, is transmitted by this system of ossicles to what is located here in the inner ear. Here in the inner ear is first what we call the cochlea, which is filled with a fluid, and in which the auditory nerve ends. Placed on it, in front, are the three so-called semicircular canals, whose surfaces are perpendicular to each other in the three dimensions of space. So you can imagine it as follows. Sound, in the form of air waves, penetrates here. It progresses through the ossicles and reaches the fluid. There, it reaches the nerves and acts upon the sensing brain. So there we have the eye as a sense organ and the ear as another sense organ. In this way, we can look at these two things neatly juxtaposed, and as a further abstraction, we can determine a common theory of the physiology of sense perception. However, the matter won't seem so simple if you take what I said about the combined effect of the whole rhythm of the rising and falling cerebrospinal fluid and put it together with what happens externally in the air. For as you will recall me saying, we shouldn't simply assume that something that appears superficially to be self-contained is a complete reality. The rose that I break off the rose bush is not a reality, for it can't exist by itself. It can achieve an existence only by virtue of its connection to the rose bush. In truth, it's an abstraction, if I think about it merely as a rose. I have to go on to the totality, at least to the whole rose bush. Thus, in hearing, the ear is not at all a reality, the ear that is usually described. What is propagated from outside to the inside, through the ear, has to interact with the process of inner rhythm manifested in the rising and falling of the cerebrospinal fluid. Thus we extend what is happening in the ear to what is happening within these rhythmic movements of the cerebrospinal fluid. Even then we're not finished. What happens rhythmically in the human being, including the brain in its domain, is in turn the foundation of something that manifests itself in a completely different aspect of our organism, in the act of speaking, by means of the larynx and the neighboring organs. Of course, your active speech is, in terms of its tools, integrated into the breathing process, which is also the foundation of this rhythmic process of the rising and falling cerebrospinal fluid. On the one hand, you can just as well include your speech process as part of everything that takes place rhythmically in you when you breathe, and, on the other hand, you can include hearing. Then you have a whole, which manifests itself in the act of hearing, more in terms of the intellect, and in the act of speech, more in terms of the will. You only have a whole if you combine the will element, which is pulsing through the larynx, with the more intellectual and sensual element, which passes through the ear. They belong together. We have to see this clearly as a simple fact. If we take either the ear or the larynx out of context, it is only an abstraction. You will never arrive at a whole if you separate things that belong together from each other. The physiological physicists or physiological physiologists who study the ear and the larynx in isolation are acting in terms of their research procedures in exactly the same way that you would be if, in order to heal a person, you dissected him or her, instead of studying things in their organic interaction. Once we have a proper grasp of what we are concerned with here, we come to the following. Observe what is left of the eye when I have taken away the vitreous body and all or part of the retina. See figure 3F. If I could remove all of this, then the ciliary muscle, the lens, and the outer fluid would remain. And what kind of organ would that be? If I work realistically, that would be an organ I would never compare to the ear. Instead, I would have to compare it with the larynx. That is not a metamorphosis of the ear. It's really a metamorphosis of the larynx. To give you only the most general idea, just as the laryngeal muscles grasp the vocal cords, making a wider or narrower slit, the ciliary muscles do the same here. They grasp the lens, which is inwardly mobile. I've separated out the elements that are larynx-like for the etheric, in the way that our larynx is larynx-like for the air. And if I put first the retina and then the vitreous body back in, and with certain animals I would have to put in certain organs, such as the pectin, which is present only etherically in the human being, or the falciform process. In certain lower animals, these extend inward as vascular organs. If I include all of that, then I can only compare it with the ear. I would compare such things as the spreading parts of the pectin with the spreading parts of the labyrinth in the ear, and so forth. Thus, at one level in the human organism, I have the eye, which internally is a metamorphosed ear that is enclosed externally by a metamorphosed larynx. On the other hand, if we take the larynx and the ear together as a whole, then at another level, we have a metamorphosed eye. I've indicated something that leads in a very important direction. We can't know anything at all about these things if we compare them with each other in a completely false way, simply by placing eye and ear next to each other. On the contrary, when comparing the eye with the ear, I should look only at what lies behind the lens in the eye, which has more vitality. While in the case of the human larynx, I have to compare what pushes out in front here and is more of a muscular nature. That's what makes the science of metamorphoses difficult. You can't look for the metamorphoses in a simplistic way. You have to investigate the inner dynamic, the reality, the actuality. However, if that is the case, we are constrained from comparing sound and light so easily as parallel phenomena. If we start out from the false premise that the eye and the ear are equally sense organs, then we will have a completely false view of what follows from this relationship. When I see, it is something quite different from when I hear. When I see, the same thing happens in the eye as when I hear and speak at the same time. On a higher level, an activity that I can only compare to speaking accompanies the actual receptive activity of the eye. We can really achieve something in this area only if we try to grasp the realities. For when we become aware that here in the eye two different kinds of things are united, which otherwise, in the case of hearing, of sound, are shifted to apparently completely different bodily organs, then we start to realize that in seeing, in the eye, something takes place that is like a kind of communication with oneself. The eye always acts the way that you act when you hear something and repeat it first, in order to understand it. The nature of the eye's activity is really as if you listened but didn't grasp it correctly yet. If the other person says, quote, "He is writing," close quote, you're still unclear, so you repeat, quote, "He is writing," close quote. Only then is the whole matter complete. That's the way it is for the eye with light phenomena. They enter our consciousness because of the curious fact that our eye has a vital part. But this becomes the full experience of sight only when we reproduce it in the part of the eye, located in the front, that corresponds to the larynx. When we see, we are speaking with ourselves etherically. The eye is talking to itself. Thus we can't compare something that is the result of talking with ourselves, in other words, something that already comprises the typical activity of the human being, with hearing alone, which is only one element, one part. If you thoroughly think this idea over for yourself, you can gain an extraordinary amount from it. because you can see how far the materialistic view of the world has wandered off into absolute unreality by comparing things that are not directly comparable at all, such as the ear and the eye. Because of the very superficiality of this way of viewing things, which does not look at real wholes, we stray from a spiritual view of nature. Period. Consider to what degree the conclusion of Goethe's theory of color in the sensory moral section derives the spiritual from the physical. And you can never do this if your basis is the current physical theory of color. Now, however, we begin to have doubts about sound, whether it is as self-evident as they say that externally sound is only a matter of vibrations. But you have to ask yourself this question, and I ask you to decide for yourself whether this question isn't already answered to a certain extent by being asked in the right way. Could the following be the case? Let's say that you have a globe here filled with air, and that you also have a hole in the globe that can be opened by a valve. Nothing will happen as long as the air on the inside has the same density as the air on the outside, even if you open the hole. But if there is a vacuum in the globe, then something will indeed happen. The outer air will whistle in and fill up the empty space. Would you by any chance say, in this case, that the air that is inside afterward has simply been created by what happened inside? No, you would say that the air penetrated from outside. However, based purely on observation, the empty space sucked the outer air in. When we start the disc spinning and shoot air through here, we simply create the conditions for something to happen, which we have to call a sucking effect. What emerges afterward, in the form of sound, when I set the siren in motion and cause the air to vibrate, that is beyond the space. It is not yet inside the space. The conditions aren't there for it to come into the space until I produce them, just as the conditions aren't there for the outer air to rush in here until I produce them. I can only compare the external air vibrations to the vacuum, and I can only compare the audible sound to the outside air that penetrates the vacuum because the conditions have been created for it. But intrinsically, in their essence, the vibrations of the air have nothing to do with the sound, except that where these air vibrations are a vacuum effect takes place, which pulls the sound in. It goes without saying that the nature of the sound that is pulled in will be modified depending on the type of air vibrations. But it would also be modified here in the vacuum if I were to make passages here and the air expanded along certain paths. Then these passages would be a copy of the lines along which the air expands. Likewise, sound phenomena are copied in the vibration phenomena that take place externally. So you see that it isn't so easy to imagine how by means of a few mathematical ideas about vibration phenomena we can indicate the basis of a real physics of sound. It makes more demands on the qualitative in human thinking. But unless we fulfill these demands adequately, we will create only that construct of a physical conception of the world, the physical worldview that we worship today, that relates to reality the way a papier-mâché person relates to a living human being. Think that over, and we'll continue next Friday, the end of Lecture 8.